I'm going to open an informational hearing. I'm going to ask Sharon Genesee to come on up and to show us a video that I was given. I took it home and watched it, and I felt it was a perfect time with the issues we're dealing with today to have a look at this. And so let me go ahead and do this officially. And so we're in an informational hearing, informational public hearing. Sharon, the floor is yours. If you might want to go ahead, too, you can grab that mic off right there.
Okay. I'm a documentary filmmaker, and so that's primarily what I do. But I also live in Northwest Portland, where we get some very, very strong industrial smells that are they're very peculiar, and they're very they make people ill, and they're very upsetting. So as a documentary filmmaker, I thought it seemed like a good idea to investigate what the smells were. I'm chairman of the Health and Environment Committee for the Northwest District Association. That's our local neighborhood association. So we started a whole year in 1997. We worked with the DEQ. We set bucket monitors that the neighbors could actually take samples themselves for 43 hazardous air pollutants in their homes, or outside their homes, right near the industrial sanctuary in Portland. The DEQ set up their monitors in very similar places, and between the two of us, we found over 70 toxic compounds in our neighborhood air. So this is a 24-and-a-half-minute piece. It's called What's in Our Air. We filmed it in two neighborhoods of Portland, in North Portland, near the Columbia Village, which is near Columbia Boulevard, and in Northwest Portland, in Richmond, California, where they recently had a big explosion at the Chevron refinery, and in Martinez, California, and in Seattle, Washington, where neighbors are all beginning to use bucket monitors to capture samples of the air when it smells bad so they can find out what they're taking into their lungs themselves and their family.
I had forgotten that thing was that long, so could you go ahead and start it?
And then take it off whenever you need to.
Okay. All right.
Let's see. Can we get the...
Okay, it's been a while, so we're going to sit back and relax. So, bring popcorn.
I moved in here in the fall and I was born and I noticed the smell in the wintertime. Actually, I wasn't sure where it was. In the recession, the summertime was falling near 95. It was absolutely horrendous. This is really awful metallic smell that attached to the back of your throat. It can get caught in the hard water.
You have to survive, you have to be able to, you're going to have some business. been on this team, you want to see who survives to be awesome. And sometimes it's just that. Kumbaya! 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 Kumbaya!
These people live in their industry in an open part of Cleveland, Florida. On the other side, they look up their lives again. They all live in the land of nature.
So
working with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality and consultant scientist, Dr. Robert Amundsen, they sampled for 43 hazardous air pollutants using road test bus monitors when they smell strong, familiar odors.
They've been going out on the St. Northwest here to see the major testing of the company to optimize the air.
The budget managers will develop a community for a better environment in San Francisco.
And what goes into the air also goes into the water. And what goes into the water also goes into the earth and contaminates the earth. And what comes out of the earth with its vegetation, with its vegetation, comes out of the earth. We don't recognize that rich vegetation is umbilical cord allowed to work.
I can probably deny the very composing of problem at all.
What they were observing about cancer rates being high. And so there was literally a 50-year battle with the state of California to do a health study along with the facilities out here in Santa Costa County that these facilities are located. It took 50 years of battle to get that study. When the study was completed, it did show a higher rate of various cancers, including domestic blood cancers, within itself. Industry immediately came in and paid for another study to blame it on lifestyle. The fact that we have a lot of blue collar people living here that smoke more and have bad diet. But the subsequent UC Berkeley study, on that study, showed that although it was true that there were lifestyles which could contribute to our cancer rates, the cancer rates were so high that they could not be explained away by bad diet and smoking. But they were so high that the only credible reason for that was excess industrial emissions on cancer-related outcomes. Today we are releasing the results of those samples that were undertaken on major contaminants like Portland. The predominant compounds that were found were iron, polyene, benzene, and methylene ketone, and then a wide variety of other compounds.
At a press conference in Portland, the industry's air quality data gathered near their home.
I can't work in my garden in the morning when my house is engulfed in this smog that keeps outrageous. I turn out a beast, and I'm going to die. And I'm kind of underneath this. And I don't understand why we had a little bit of beer and salt.
According to DEQ and Nature's Book of Data, there are over 70 toxic compounds in Northwest Portland's air.
What can you say about the combinations of the various things that
you've got? Well, one of the things you always have to worry about is that you have to have a checkout for the carbon toxicology threshold. For individual compounds on the other side, and that might work well in the study. We, you know, a worker is supposed to be one of the compounds on the top of the
We must take another step and apply only this
use pollution control technology to protect the air pollution.
A lot of people here, they shouldn't complain, but our children do have the right to breathe clean air and not be in there and come over and try to get more people to where they do. All you want to be able to do is smell something, you turn on the vacuum, you open your mouth, and now there's a negative pressure around the bag. And because
those of us exposed to toxic air emissions, and working together to find a way to reduce exposure to pollutants in our air. Even the worst who knows what we are doing.
I have a beautiful design.
Is the bucket brigade still functioning?
Okay. We just got $1,000 from NESCO shareholders to spend on. We'll continue to monitor. We're not only using the bucket, but we're also sending out glass dishes that catch particulates, you know, in the air, like dust. And these carry molecules of positive air pollutant environment.
Okay, now you and I talked before we headed down here about the idea of whether or not the recovery systems are functioning, and on the barge exchanges and the truck. And we're going to have DEQ folks here, so I'm glad you reminded me of that. And so we'll maybe get an additional report on that as to what's happening, the direction of that.
At the moment, there is no capture equipment during the loading and unloading of the barge. Tanker. But not what we're talking about here.
Any other questions, Senator Goodjuice?
I was just curious. You've had the time to go to a number of communities and videotape and put the movie together, so you've been objecting for at least that long, and I assume quite a bit longer than that. Has anything been done to clean up any of this?
Well, one thing that we're really thrilled about, as a matter of fact, is this requirement to put capture equipment on the tankers loading and unloading, because every time this happens, an enormous amount of benzene.
But didn't you say that they've made a decision to move forward with that, but nothing has actually? So in this time period, there have been no reduction in the emissions. The agency has now decided, however, to take a particular.
Okay.
Sharon, would you swing that mic over a little bit closer? I don't know if it's okay.
We would like to see some kind of sort of fence line monitoring, which would acknowledge the fact that the air quality in the whole state, as a matter of fact, is not the same for everybody. We have hot spots. The people who are living the closest to industry are the most affected. And these people are not being treated fairly, because the word we get is that most of the air pollution is coming from traffic. They get plenty of traffic, but they also get industrial pollution. So if we have some kind of fence line monitoring which makes sure like in our case where we have an industrial sanctuary, which is fairly there, and it's all agreed that it should be there, but if their pollution is too high over and it comes over into the residential area right next to it, this has to be checked on a regular basis. I mean, I had a woman at my house this week who has MS, and now she has multiple chemical sensitivity syndrome. Her daughter has chronic fatigue syndrome. The man across the street is a runner who has been running up and down that same Thurman, which is right by the industrial area. He has the worst case, she says, of chronic fatigue syndrome she's ever seen. The boy next door died of asthma. I mean, we're going to start a serious health study on our neighborhood. That's the next project, and that we hope to start this summer.
How long have you and others been working on this particular area?
Well, I've been involved in this for about 5 years.
In this particular area?
Yes, is where I live. So I started right away because these smells make you feel ill, and they're very, very, at the very least, even if you don't feel ill from them, I mean, it's very annoying to live where you have really strong industrial odors. It's not good.
Sure, there was some good news in there, and that was on the solid recovery at dry cleaners. And I remember when that whole discussion was going on, there was kind of a doom and gloom scenario that all these people would be put out of business. Have you seen any numbers on that as to what effect that has had? I know there was a little rise in charges, but...
Right, there is. And I talked to Steve Young about that, and he said, sure, he said, we have some dry cleaners that aren't very happy about this. But on the whole, it hasn't made a difference. I mean, certainly in our neighborhood, everybody's happy to pay that little extra because we know that we have cleaner air as a result. And especially now with the new EPA report out on the cumulative impact, have you all heard about this? Eight carcinogenic chemicals found in most American cities, including small towns, and they don't know anything about what this means in terms of cumulative impact. So in a neighborhood like ours where we have over 70, nobody knows what this really means.
You know, when I was watching that, I was thinking about, you know, the fact that they were saying accumulation of a large number of chemicals. You may be safe here with this one. You may be safe with this one, but you put the whole group together and it may not be the case. And I was thinking about the fact that, you know, so many times those of us who've handled pesticides for so long, you know, we've dealt with this stuff. And Geico, when you get my regular blood test.
Just as we suspect.
No. I do get a regular drug test, though, by the way. I have CDL protein, so I have a regular drug test.
Right.
But anyway, the interesting thing was is that, see, because of the fact that we're out in the country and you're exposed to breathe, good air, other than that one individual chemical exposure, it really would have begun to bother me to think about how many you might be exposed to where you live.
Yes, because a lot of pesticides are used in the inner city. So if you have that route of exposure, plus you're breathing it, plus you're getting some stuff in the water, one of the annoying things to us is the bragging brochures that the water department puts out, which are wonderful, that say bovine water is so clean we don't have these chemicals. And these are the same chemicals that we're picking up that we're breathing.
They're actually reported in the water.
Yeah. And what we really need to think about is the transfer from air to water. So if we care about cleaning up the water, we've also got to clean up the airship.
Senator Corcoran, I saw you.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'd just like to get, since we have an expert here, and I see that you have my good constituent, Dr. Engelking from U of O, in there. He talked about the compound effect of multiple carcinogens or multiple chemicals. Where do you come down on the issue of that's big in the building right now in terms of pesticide rights to know and toxic rights to know laws in general?
Well, I think speaking for myself personally and everybody I know who knows someone or who has cancer in their family, I mean, it just stands to reason that you want to know what you were exposed to. You know, why are all my friends getting breast cancer? Why do I have all this asthma in my neighborhood? You know, it's just an intelligent response to something that we're observing around ourselves. And I think it's logical to want to know what we're breathing, what we're drinking, what we're eating.
Thank you.
Sharon, thank you very much. You might want to stick around for the following bills unless you have to leave.
I have to leave.
I'm going to
leave you another copy of the tape.
I'm going to
get it to Brad.
I'm missing tape.
Okay.
All right. Thanks again. Okay. I'm going to close the informational hearing. And what's going on? I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1100. Senator Wilde, I'll let you tell us about the bill. I won't even bother Brad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of my committee. First of all, I'd just like to make a statement about previous testimony, which is I live right across the river from there up on the bluffs, and I get that air regularly. I came to Oregon and to Portland with what would be considered perfect lungs, and never had problems of any kind whatsoever. I would say about a third of the year now, I have something approaching asthma or bronchitis, and I have a difficult time breathing. And I don't know if it's merely coincidence, but I'll tell you, I am looking forward to getting out of the Portland metro area because I do not think it's very good for my health. And I have two young children, and it worries me tremendously that I am raising them in an environment where I can go out and wipe my finger across my siding and have it be black, and that bothers me. And I don't think it's a very responsible father who would raise his children in that environment, and so I will seek a different place to raise them because I don't wish to continue. So that being said, let's get to Senate Bill 1100, and I'll touch on 1101 as well. And I brought these forward because my feeling is that there are things you can do cost-effectively in terms of the environment, in terms of people's health, and there are things that are prohibitively expensive. And when I sat down, I thought of what can we do for a reasonable price that will have a tremendous impact. This is one that I came across and I did quite a lot of research on, because it goes back to the days when I was a violin maker, which is kind of odd. You wouldn't tie that into this bill, except for the fact that many of the woods that I got, especially when I get from old violin makers, that sort of thing, came from overseas, Bosnian maple, Swiss spruce. And I went over to those countries, and I would see the people who cut the trees and see the old timers, and get their opinion as to what they used to be able to cut and what they were able to cut now. And I used to think acid rain, yeah, we all complain about it, we all talk about it, but it's just one of those environmental things that you just sort of say. It sounds good. And in talking to the people who cut down the trees, they gave me stories, and I got to see the different wood samples, and there was this huge difference over the years. The quality, the texture of the wood, the strength of the wood. I've seen microscope pictures of the cells within the wood, and it has all changed, and a lot of that has been because of the sulfur emissions in the air that have come down as acid rain. And so I sat down and I said, okay, I'm not going to take on all of industry, I'm not going to do that, but what do we have that for perhaps, in this case, 3 to 5 cents a gallon, we could have perhaps a 90% reduction in the sulfur we put out. And this is what I came forward with, is that especially the 30-80 standard, which is 30 parts per million with an 80 parts per million maximum. And if you see around the country, current is anywhere from 300 to, say, 450 parts per million would be standard in gasoline, 500 parts per million in diesel fuels. And this type of reduction for that type of cost, and yes, there's a large upfront cost for the refiners if they have not gotten to this standard in terms of what they're able to refine. And very large. We're talking $1 billion would not be out of the question. But there are two factors in this. Where does their crude oil supply come from, which will determine its sulfur content, and also what has been required in their area, such as in California, the 3080 standard has existed, and they are operating under that standard. Recently, Canada adopted the standard to be implemented by 2004. Japan has adopted the standard. England has adopted the standard. The entire European community has adopted the standard. And so all of the refineries that deal with these various areas are gearing up toward providing this level of sulfur content. But when you have a crude oil supply, such as, say, the North Slope, which is what we get, that is a higher sulfur content petroleum. It takes a lot more refining. It then costs more. And so it was much less likely that, say, refineries in the Puget Sound area, which got that petroleum, or that crude, would without any standards of this type, would go to the trouble of spending the massive amounts of money it would take to get down to these standards. You then take something like a Texas, it's called Texas Sweet. That's because it's lower in sulfur content, so you don't have to refine it nearly as much to get down to these standards. Various North Sea crude is one, then you get down into the Middle East. I mean, each one has a different sulfur content. But the key is that when it's burned, it all comes out. I mean, your catalytic converter, one of the reasons you have to replace it is because of the sulfur content in the gasoline. The less sulfur there is, the longer that's going to last. I sat down and said, okay, this is one that makes sense to pursue, because most of you know I'm not too big on heavy-duty government. But when it can be done for a reasonable cost overall in relation to its health benefit, I'm willing to do that. And so I wanted to bring this forward. I've asked the chair not to move either 1100 or 1101 today, but instead let's just discuss the various issues, and I probably will come back with amendments based on the discussions I've had prior to this hearing and in anticipation of what I will hear during this hearing. I would like to say that I have been a little frustrated in dealing with the government agencies on this. That's probably putting it mildly. Because right now, EPA sets standards for the country as a whole, except California. And I would like to say New Jersey has adopted this standard, although it has not yet been implemented. I've had a rocky relationship with our Department of Environmental Quality, and the immediate reaction was, well, the feds decide, so don't bother doing anything about this. Well, in my opinion as an elected official, I'm here to represent the people. I don't represent the government, I represent the people. And it's in my opinion that this is essential and quite important. And I don't really appreciate it when I hear government agencies saying, well, you know, the cars coming out in the 2004 model year are going to need this kind of fuel anyway, so we're going to get around to this standard one way or the other. Well, that's fine and dandy, but our job is really to protect the health of the people. And if it can be done at 3 or 4 cents a gallon, I'm willing to push for that. So, not knowing what the testimony will be following behind me, I would just like to say thanks for letting me bring it forward.
You bet. Are there any questions for Senator Wilde? No? Thank you. Brad, who's next?
We have Chris Hagerbaumer from Oregon Environmental Council.
Welcome. Thank you. Members of the committee, I guess we don't need a chair, co-chair Wilde, and members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Chris Hagerbaumer. I'm the Air and Transportation Director for the Oregon Environmental Council. OEC is the oldest statewide advocacy group environmental advocacy group in Portland. We work on restoring and protecting Oregon's clean air and water. Basically, we believe that SB 1101 is right on target. Sulfur and gasoline increases numerous emissions. I mean, basically the whole gamut of bad air emissions, including those that cause or contribute to smog, fine particulate matter, carbon monoxide, toxic air pollution, and global climate change. That's basically because sulfur inhibits the performance of pollution control equipment. Studies have shown that tailpipe pollution from older cars increases by 10 to 20% if gasoline sulfur levels are high. Sulfur causes even greater problems for the low-emission and ultra-low-emission vehicles that are coming out, especially in California. Low sulfur gasoline would mean cleaner air and fewer respiratory problems. In California, low sulfur gasoline has been cited as the single most effective pollution reduction measure since the introduction of the catalytic converter in the 70s. It's the equivalent of taking millions of cars off the road. Lower sulfur gasoline could also make big improvements in global warming because it would permit introduction of more efficient new technologies. Unfortunately, we can't support the bill as it stands because we think that it's both feasible and cost-effective to reduce the sulfur content further. Sulfur, as Thunder the Wild mentioned, the sulfur content of California gasoline is limited to an average of about 30 to 40 parts per million, and we believe the target of 150 parts per million is not quite strong enough. Recent technological innovations cited by the EPA suggest the cleanup could actually be accomplished for as little as 1 to 2 cents per gallon. What may have to do is whether it was done at a national level or not. So if the bill were amended to reduce the amount of sulfur to 30 parts per million, we would support it. And then when I was thinking about this bill and thinking about the fact that the EPA is supposed to promulgate rules fairly soon, and I share a little bit of Senator Wild's skepticism that that might actually happen, but I think that it would be great if we took this bill and turned it into Senate joint resolution to Congress to basically encourage them to implement this on a nationwide level. Thank you, and I'll take any questions.
I've got some really bad news for you if they don't listen.
That's partly why I did it the way I did.
I guess, Mr. Chairman, my question would be, do you know what the current status is in terms of parts per million?
Well, Senator Parker, I believe that in Oregon it might be around 350 parts per million. I'm not sure. I know the average in the United States is 450 to 500 parts per million.
Okay, thanks.
I know from what I've seen in our state, about 325 to 350 would be considered pretty standard. So, and I would like to explain 150 because it was what I would call an immediate compromise figure, such as in asking industry what can you deliver to me tomorrow on your next truck. 150 parts per million was very doable. And in waiting for all of these other things that might take place, I thought, if you can go and get it the first day possible, go for it, without a tremendous amount of opposition. On the other hand, I did mention amendments, and probably what I will bring forward is 3080 standard and just plain put it into the current bill of 1101. Because if it's going to have opposition at 150 or any other figure, it's going to have opposition at 3080, so I might as well go for what I really want. Any other questions?
I have a question for you. What is the 30 the sulfur and 80 is?
3080. 80 is simply the maximum you can ever possibly get.
Okay.
Only with the outside, but 30 is what you're really going for.
Okay.
And would you also like to, would you like to testify in both bills at the same time?
Sure.
Okay. The past talk, that's, I'd like to know why you're going to chair.
Then we're going to deal with the other 102,000 chemicals coming from your district.
Hey, I got farms and stuff. Don't be messing with my farms.
That's fine.
Senator George, members of the committee, again for the record, Chris Hagerbaumer, Oregon Environmental Council. And I'd like to thank both Senators George and Wild for this is Senate Bill 1101. And I'd like to thank you both very much for clearly identifying the need for Oregon to reduce both toxic and particulate emissions. These emissions are known to have significant health and environmental effects, and we have been working for years on different strategies to reduce them. Currently, staff member Sarah Dahl sits on the Hazardous Air Pollutant Advisory Committee. I recently sat on the Heavy-Duty Diesel Advisory Committee, which would implement a program of testing heavy-duty diesel trucks and lower particulate and toxic emissions. This field would set up a task force to determine how to reduce both of these types of emissions. And with respect to toxic emissions, we do believe that Oregon's current approach isn't enough to reduce emissions to levels that don't endanger public health. But we do believe that the process that we're involved in, the Hazardous Air Pollutant Consensus Group, is the best approach to this problem, so we wouldn't really support a duplicative task force. On the other hand, with respect to fine particulate emissions, we would support creating a task force to look at effective ways to reduce those. DEC is currently monitoring areas of the state to determine which will be in attainment of the new federal standards for PM2.5. And the first designations are expected to go, I think, to be between 2001 and 2003. And in the realm of planning, that's not really very far off. So projected problem areas include a lot of different places in the state, both small and big, from Portland to Lakeview. Now, DEQ has been proactive in this area, but I think that there's always room for improvement. And an independent task force could possibly, hopefully, identify good and cost-effective strategies that would shore up the efforts of DEQ. Likewise, with respect to the sulfur content of fuel, which is another part of the spill, DEQ has been actively encouraging EPA to enact limits, but it could be helpful to have the weight of a task force behind those recommendations. And finally, I wanted to put in a plug for fully funding DEQ's efforts in this area. I mean, if we all believe that these emissions are a problem, we really need to give DEQ the resources to address those. Thank you, and I'd be happy again to take questions.
Senator Corcoran?
I couldn't help but notice the mention of Oak Ridge. Fine particulate emissions. Do you know what those emissions might be coming from in Oak Ridge?
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, I'm sorry, I'm blanking all of a sudden, but it's the...
Probably a wood stove.
Hey, wood stove.
They don't have any jobs there. They don't have any industry. So what are you going to do, take away the wood stoves?
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, I don't think the issue is taking away wood stoves. The OEC was actually instrumental in helping pass law to get better wood stoves out on the market. But I think that, I know that in some communities, I think in Boise, for example, they've actually had to limit when people could use wood stoves, because of the whole air inversion problems and so on. And I don't really know how else to address it, but there's also, I mean, I guess that's part of the things that one of a task force like this would look at.
Senator Fisher?
And it's the sulfur in the wood. That's Senator Corcoran.
Oak Ridge needs all the help it can get.
Senator Goose.
These are poor people.
Senator George, Chair George, Senator Dukes, I don't know how that they do this in Boise. Maybe it's like on a particularly bad day. I mean, here, for example, a totally different kind of strategy, but in Paris on really bad air days, cars with even numbered plates can drive on one day, cars with odd numbered plates on another day, and that's really kind of a draconian measure for dealing with the problem. But again, I think that's something that this task force could look at.
Yeah. Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. That'll fly. Yeah. Sure.
Senator Wilde, thank you. In response to Senator Duke's inquiry, Missoula, Montana ran into that because they have a bowl of mountains there, and they heated primarily with wood stoves, and it was bad. You couldn't see the mountains, even though they were very large, because there was no way of cleaning out the air. And what they actually did was, one, they stopped any further development until they came up with some way of dealing with the problem. Two, they started putting in other heating systems. Three, they required much higher standards for the wood stoves that would be allowed to operate. And over about a five-year period, they made a huge change. So it can be done, and it's not always cheap, but when you can barely see your neighbor's house, And I ran into that when we were over in China. There's a place called Xi'an, which is a tourist area. And I had to actually take the hotel towel and wrap it around my face. It hurt my lungs so much. And you could not see more than a block away. You truly couldn't. And this will get you. But Senator Yi actually chewed out the mayor before we left and said, "You have the worst air I've run into." But those things happen, and it takes extraordinary measures, which generally are not cheap, and it's why we probably should do it incrementally over a period of time when we see that a problem could exist instead of waiting until it's a disaster.
Chris, before you go, one of the things, I think we live in a rather unique and maybe a glorious time as far as technology addressing these things. And to a certain extent, it never would have happened if it hadn't been for the environmental community keeping the pressure on. And I look, I was thinking coming down here today, I was watching some trucks pull away from an intersection, and I could spot all of the later model trucks which have the computer-adjusted fuel injection. And you can stop the throttle to the floor, and you won't see the black particulate smoke coming out of those trucks anymore. They adjust the burn in order to address the ability of that motor to produce the power that its maximum can without the pollution level. And to realize that technology is moving so fast. In fact, we're going to have DEQ folks up here in a little bit, and we were discussing in our office about 10 days ago about, you know, the new cars that are coming our way, the 2003, 2006 vehicles that are coming. In fact, we joked today it wasn't a joke, I mean, it's a very serious issue, at a Chamber of Commerce meeting, that these cars actually will be so environmentally friendly that they're going to only offer them in green. But it is a good thing to keep this pressure on, as Senator Dukes asked the question about, you know, how long have you been working on Northwest Portland's air problem? And, you know, we've seen some movement, and a lot of times where business is finding out that this is good business, you know, to be environmentally sensitive. So I think this is a real opportunity to discuss this, and as Senator Wilde said, to incrementally look at making this change, you know, particularly to low sulfur emissions and what we can do with particulate matter from wood stoves. So anyway, any further questions? Thank you for listening to my sermon.
Thank you.
So in the farm community, Mr. Chair, there'll be lime green cars represented. Yeah.
John Deere will be happy.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Hang on for 1 second, Senator Fisher, and we'll get back to it. What we did is we need to clarify that we are, at this time, because the bills are paired together, we're doing a public hearing on both Senate Bill 1100 and 1101. So I'm going to announce that, get that officially on the record. Senator Fisher.
If they make it on part of 101, we want to make sure they have what to see.
Bob Russell, OTA. going to tell us that the diesel tax is less polluting. Watch. Watch.
You're correct.
No, I knew that.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Bussell. I'm Director of Government Affairs for OTA, and I'm also representing the Oregon Forest Products Transportation Association today. Unfortunately, none of us are experts in this technology and what these new requirements or new standards would do to diesel truck engines. So we would like an opportunity to bring some experts from the truck manufacturers back to the committee so you folks can hear what the new standards will do to diesel engines and what it will require, if that's okay with you.
Bob, too, and we'll schedule around that expert because we did want to address that issue. I've talked with Senator Wilde about that. So we'll wait to hear from your folks, but also have them bring information about the technology that I understand is on its way and as far as what we can look for in the future and how this will fit. In other words, there's probably a pace already out in front of us, and we want to make sure we align with that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Brad, who's next?
Langdon Marsh and Greg Green from the Department of Environmental Quality.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. I'm Langdon Marsh, Director of DEQ, and with me is Greg Green, Administrator of our Air Quality Division. And I'd like to address both bills, if I may. As you indicated, I'd like to thank you and Senator Wilde, Mr. Chair, for your interest in clean air and supporting the progress in technology that we've been talking about today. And I think it's very encouraging that we're here talking about clean air for all of Oregon. Senate Bill 1101, I could begin with that, because most of what I wanted to say has already been said. We strongly support lower sulfur emission caps on gasoline and diesel fuel. It has a tremendous potential for cleaning our air over the next period of time. We think the current sulfur, average sulfur content in gasoline is around 400 parts per million, could be a little bit more, a little bit less. I think the count nationally is quite a bit higher than that, so we could be getting occasional hits of even higher amounts than the average. The national average is around 500 parts per million, so you can see there'd be significant improvements from a cap just being suggested. And we also agree with the former speaker that we support the 30 parts per million average with an 80 parts per million per gallon cap. The statistic we like to use is that limiting sulfur levels to 30 parts per million would be like taking 500,000 cars and trucks from our roadways and just in the Portland and Salem region alone, and that's a tremendous benefit in terms of air quality. Not much benefit, I guess, in terms of congestion because those cars would still be there, but they'd be producing a whole lot less pollution. We think that the technology exists for refineries to be able to produce gasoline at that low level, perhaps not overnight, but fairly soon. There is a problem for some of the smaller refineries, particularly in the Rocky Mountain states, maybe one or so in the Puget Sound area. And we have requested the EPA to take that into account in adopting a national cap, hopefully at that same level. We think a national cap does make sense because that will make probably the least cost way of implementing a sulfur cap. We do expect them to act fairly soon. I also appreciate the concern shown by this bill and think that a demonstration by the state of Oregon of the seriousness of purpose of having a cap identical to the one we've espoused on the national level would send a very strong signal that this kind of gasoline is what we want and what we deserve. So we would support amendments to the bill along the lines that Senator Wild mentioned in his testimony and his response to the remarks, and we're certainly willing to work on the technical aspects of that amendment.
Senator Wild.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to ask, in terms of heavy truck diesel engines, now the current standard, I believe, is 500 parts per million nationally, and what would be your take? Would it be to leave that alone at that? And do you know if the federal government is intending to alter their requirements?
Mr. Chair, Senator Wild, what we advocated, and when I say we, it's a number of states from all over the country, got together and went to Washington, and I was privileged to be their spokesperson and advocated very strongly for a 30 parts per million average and 80 parts cap. And while we don't have absolute information about it, we think that what is working its way through the administration is something very close to that. When exactly and how it would be implemented are very much in the dark to us, however.
Senator Wild?
Now, that applies to diesel engines as well?
Chair Senator Wild, yes. I believe it's the identical standard.
Okay. Mr. Chair. Senator Fisher.
I take it, at least in cars, that this mechanical problems or any converting things you like it reasonably doesn't have the effect that on valve loop. So, how about diesel engines?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I'm not aware of any benefit from an operational point of view that sulfur and fuel gives to either a gasoline or a diesel engine. Maybe Mr. Green has some additional information. However, it does have a clear deleterious impact that sulfur does, as Senator Wild indicated in his testimony, I think, on the operation of the catalytic converters in the gasoline powered engines and causes a further deterioration in them. I believe it also has an effect on some of the systems for diesel engines as well, an adverse effect. So do you have anything further?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, no. As far as I know, it's just the effect on the catalytic converter that causes the problem, but there's neither a benefit nor a negative associated with low sulfur fuel in our model.
I've heard that there was a little bit of a cushioning because of the high compression that's necessary to fire the diesel. That will be something maybe because we're going to have some folks in from the engine manufacturers who can really help us with this. I think, like the technology with an automobile, earlier we said you couldn't remove the lead and then couldn't remove the sulfur. Now we realize that all those things are possible. Technology is changing dramatically. One of the things relative to the sulfur, though, is when you smell a catalytic converter, is that, and it smells like rotten eggs, that is correct sulfur that's being burned in the catalytic converter?
Mr. Chair, I believe that's correct. I believe that particularly in the initial stages of the warming of the catalytic converter, you get quite a noticeable odor, which is sulfur or sulfur compounds.
You folks were in my office. We were talking about my wife's automobile and the fact that she's had trouble with the sensor that's in the catalytic converter. And this sensor, according to the Nissan dealership, it regulates the carburetors on that thing. And what we were having was about every 8 to 10 months it would burn out, and they said it was because of the sulfur in Oregon's gasoline that was occurring. And they had pointed, and this is why Senator Wild and I got together on this bill, is, my goodness, if we have cars that are anticipating, you know, low sulfur fuel, maybe we should look at something like that, particularly when you look at the environmental consequences of it. So apparently, a lot of these cars, and this is, I think that car is 3 years old, have been anticipating. Other areas in the world, let's say, for example, a place where that Nissan might have gone in the world, what countries do you folks know that have actually made this change to, you know, to 150 or less?
Mr. Chair, I don't know the answer to that question. I believe Canada has acted, and I'm not sure about other countries. Both of you?
Mr. Chair, Lang is correct. Canada has, in fact, acted. The entire European Union is in the process of requiring low sulfur gasoline, and I understand Japan's levels are down around 30 parts per million also.
Right, that's what I was thinking. Japan probably has.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any further questions?
Okay, Mr. Chair, just a few comments on Senate Bill 1100. Again, you know, we're very grateful for your interest in these issues. I think that the issues that are raised in the bill are exactly the right issues. I just wanted to mention a few things in relation to each of them. We talked already about the sulfur in gasoline issue, and we believe that issue may be taken care of by the promulgation of limits at the national level. But, you know, we expect that to happen before you go out of this session, so we'll be able to see whether or not that remains an issue. In terms of toxic pollutants, which is also covered in the under the proposed task force, you saw the in the video sort of part of the history of what's happened in North and Northwest Portland. As I mentioned in the as we mentioned in the hearings in Portland at OMSI, we do have a $500,000 grant from EPA to inventory and monitor toxic pollutants around the state. As was mentioned by OEC, we also have a hazardous air pollutant consensus group with 18 individuals representing a number of industry, neighborhood, environmental groups, and so forth. I have attached to the testimony a list of the members of that group. And we're asking them to address a very long list, which I've included in my testimony, of issues related to toxics in Oregon. And, you know, both exposure and health effects, how information gets public, the data analysis is required, timing, and so forth. And I would say that kind of in confirmation of Mr. Nancy's video testimony, that there is a lot more to be done here. We have not reached a state of knowledge about toxics that is satisfactory to me, I think it will take us quite a bit of additional data analysis and scientific research, some of which has to be done, I would say, at the national level. Particularly with regard to these cumulative, synergistic, and additive effects, that is something that we know a lot less about than we should. What happens when there are multiple chemicals or multiple exposures to the same individual or the same neighborhood?
You know, EPA's budget's a monster, and you keep asking, you know, as I talk with you folks, you and Greg, about, well, what do we know about this, and what do we know about that? And the answer is very little. And do you know, is there any pressure on EPA to actually get in there and get that basic research done so we know, you know, what these chemicals are doing in the environment? What are the effects of breathing this day after day?
Mr. Chair, it is an extremely complicated and daunting task. EPA, for example, has studied one compound, or one set of compounds, dioxins, for over a decade, and still has been unable to come up with a final report on the current status of knowledge about dioxins in the country and what we breathe and what we're exposed to. And this doesn't even begin to address the cumulative or synergistic effects of dioxins and other chemicals. So What we are asking our national research organizations, whether it's EPA or National Institutes of Health, to do is a tremendous task. But nevertheless, I've always argued at the national level that there isn't enough investments being made by the federal government in these studies about exactly what you're asking, because the public wants to know, what am I breathing and what is it going to do to me? And we don't have excellent answers for them at this point, particularly where multiple chemicals are involved. Some chemicals have better information about them. Some of the carcinogenic chemicals, as was mentioned, benzene, tobacco smoke, we know quite a lot about what that does. And others are just still in the beginning stage of the kind of knowledge we ought to have.
Mr. Chair. Lang, when we held our first hearing, the chair lined it up there at Portland at Amsi. It was brought out that, at least I understood it to be, that if there were a pipeline established and supposedly there's one coming somewhere down the pike, that it would reduce a tremendous amount of the pollutants around the gasoline docks up there and Port Portland, or wherever that's considered a port. I'm not sure exactly what the port boundaries are, but in any event, what's holding up the building of that pipeline? What would its effect have, not only maybe on the transfer of petroleum products there in Portland, would that also then maybe reduce the amount of truck traffic, et cetera, by using that method of pumping? Could you just kind of explain a little bit about that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, when we testified in Portland at OMSI, we mentioned that the clean air maintenance plan for the Portland metro area in Vancouver relied on this pipeline as a way of reducing the amount of volatile organic chemicals, VOCs, that were emitted from those barging and transfer operations at the terminals in Portland. And after that hearing, we inquired of the state of Washington, federal government, various folks about what the likelihood or the timetable for the establishment of that pipeline would be. We had counted on it being in place by the end, I believe, of this year, 1999. And what we discovered is that there is a elongated environmental impact process that pipeline is going through, that its future is not certain of ever being built. And in any case, it may be much extended beyond the time that we were counting on it. So as you heard Mr. Nasty say, we have determined that we should start the rulemaking process to develop some control equipment requirements for those transfer operations, as we would have done initially if the pipeline had not been there as a way of dealing with the problem. So we will be undertaking that process now.
How about transporting of it and so forth? Is that a reduction of barges, or is it a reduction of trucks? Does it come in and transfer from barge to barge and go back to Seattle or down somewhere else from Seattle, or what's the process then?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, actually, I don't think the process of transfer would, or the modal mix wouldn't change very much. It would still be probably a similar amount of barge traffic carrying much of this material, as well as the truck traffic. But the transfer operations would be controlled to a much greater extent than they are now. Let me ask Mr. Green if I can add anything to that.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Fisher, that's most of it. Right now, what happens is the fuel is piped from the Seattle region down to Portland, where the fuel that goes to eastern Washington and eastern Oregon is then thrown at barge and taken down the Columbia River. What that pipeline would have done is sent that fuel directly over to Eastern Washington and eliminated that barge traffic. If the pipeline doesn't take place, then what will happen is, as Mr. Marsh said, is we'll continue to use the barges, but instead install the capture equipment from the terminals to the barges to reduce the vapors there.
Mr. Chair, it would then reduce barge traffic to some extent if you piping it directly rather than down here and then taking it by barge back up the river.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, if the pipeline were built, it would reduce the barge traffic. In fact, it would eliminate much of it. But we're now sensing that the pipeline is not likely to be built, or at least not anytime soon. So we are going to require some controls on the transfer operations. So the barge traffic will not probably diminish very much unless there is a choice made that to do some more trucking instead, but that wouldn't be our intent to drive that decision. We would just want to put controls on the transfer operation.
Chair.
Senator Fisher?
And you kind of skirted around the area, but could I read between the lines and say that part of the same people that are hounding this to do the Queen Air are also the ones that are keeping us from getting our pipelines and stuff like that done?
Senator Fisher, there are a number of groups and individuals who are opposed to the pipeline on the, I believe it's mainly on the grounds of the impact on the particular areas that the pipeline would cross in Washington. It's not the same groups. So I think there are local groups that are concerned about wetlands and species impacts of various kinds.
Chair, just a suggestion. Perhaps those that are so opposed to it could go out with their shovels and dig it so that they didn't have to get equipment over there. They could go out and put in a little sweat and labor and stop some of the air pollution with Amber and get this job done.
Sounds like he's attacking my rototiller. But there is one thing that I found kind of curious now that we realize that pipeline probably won't be coming, is what happens if, in fact, these dams are removed? How will they, are we going to be trucking all that fuel? In other words, we're going to have grain trucks coming down and fuel trucks going back?
Mr. Chair, I haven't seen the economic impact studies of the dam removal proposal, but my understanding is that you're right, that there would be a significant increase in truck traffic, at least for the upper end of that transportation area. That there would still be plenty of barges going up as far as the snake, but at least
it
that portion.
Yeah.
As far as the Idaho portion of it, though, there would be more truck traffic undoubtedly, both directions.
Thank you very much.
Okay. I may just summarize.
I keep cutting you off.
Yeah, it's...
We were done a long time ago.
I think we keep extending it here.
Thank you, sir. We were talking in the office about the task force, and at the moment, I think it probably would be best if we just continue to have further discussions on the necessity and what is currently being done so there's not overlap, and to see if in fact there is need for legislative involvement, because at this point I'm not ready to move the bill as it is, and so it's going to need amendments anyway, so we might as well not take the time and simply keep discussing. If that is all right.
700 or
your name is on the bill, I should include you as well.
Your name is first.
No, my name is second. Your name is
up over. Finding his
1100, yeah.
700, right.
So I don't want the effort to be duplicated, because it does cost money to do this and it does take time, and the legislators are not necessarily the experts. So I'll just keep discussing it.
Chair, thank you. I look forward to hearing the discussions with the sponsors and hopefully come up with something very workable.
Okay.
Thank you.
We look forward to that.
You know, you folks probably caused a lot of this, because when you brought me this little chart and we asked the question, you guys are probably really sad you gave me this chart. You talked about this going away and part of this going away, you know, if we would just have a low sulfur fuel. So major implications, and I made a really good sale to Senator Deutsch when I suggested that we may be able to eliminate from her district and my district DEQ test stations if we could have this clean air that we'll be looking for in the future. So that might be a side benefit for a lot of the citizens. Okay, very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Brad, is there? There's no one else to testify on this. Is there anyone else who would like to just address these bills before we go? And go ahead. Okay. Thank you very much. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1100 and 1101, and I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 964. Brad, tell us about the bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 964 designates calcium hypochlorite as hazardous waste. Calcium hypochlorite is commonly known as chlorine, the type used in swimming pools. Sponsored at the request of Metro, Senate Bill 964 designates chlorine as a hazardous waste in order to protect solid waste workers from potential harm. Chlorine is caustic and can damage human skin and other tissues. When chlorine comes into contact with petroleum products, such as machine lubricants, it can react explosively. Metro has reported past instances of worker injury at solid waste transfer stations due to exposure to calcium hypochlorite. By treating chlorine as a hazardous waste, it would no longer be eligible for disposal at solid waste facilities. Instead, disposal would be limited to facilities specializing in handling hazardous waste. And Mr. Chair, I'll point out we have dash one amendments that have a typo, but it says calcium hypochlorite should be hypochlorite.
Yeah, that must be a reference to the legislature, Mr. Chair.
First up to testify, we have Ray Self and Perry Peterson. And Don Mathcock?
Welcome, folks.
Thank you. Good evening, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ray Pops. I'm here representing Metro. On my left is Kay Peterson. He's the interim director of solid waste at Metro. And on my right is Mr. Don McCott. We proposed those amendments that Mr. Harper referred to because we decided, after discussing this with a couple of different folks, that having this particular chemical classified as a hazardous waste, which I consider it is, nevertheless, I think maybe goes too far. And so what we would like to the committee to listen to our testimony, but with the viewpoint that this is just prohibited from being landfilled, this chemical, which makes things a lot less difficult with handling of the actual disposal of material.
Would you be able to then focus backwards to the person who might be disposing of some surplus pool chlorine and say, you can't do that?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so we'd keep it out of the waste stream, and so we employees would be injured by it?
Yes, sir. Mr. Peterson would like to maybe make a few comments as well, and then Mr. McCott would also.
Mr. Chair and Senators, first I want to thank you for taking the time to have a hearing on this issue. It's very important to us as an employer that we try to protect our workers, and again, thank you very much for the hearing. Metro is a regional government in the Portland area, and one of our responsibilities includes the disposal of solid waste. We dispose of about 750,000 tons of waste a year. Part of that operation includes two transfer stations. These are facilities where we accept the waste from the garbage truck, put it onto long-haul trailers for transfer out to a landfill in eastern Oregon. Senate Bill 964 was introduced at the request of Metro in order to stop what we think is a very dangerous practice of putting pool chlorine into the garbage with household and business waste. We think it's necessary to protect the health of our workers, the public, and contractor workers that we have on site at these facilities. We find chlorine in the garbage probably on a monthly basis. Usually it's handled without incident. Sometimes, though, we've had some very serious safety incidents. In the most serious incident, Mr. McCott went to the hospital for 3 days, And so it can be quite serious in terms of injuring our employees. And at this time, maybe Don would like to share with you what his experience was and what some of the long-term impacts have been on his health.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senators. I'm a lead driver at Northwest Portland Transfer Station. On January 9th, 97, while loading a trailer with your household trash, if you can visualize a 50-foot trailer that has a vent window in the front of it, and what we call a goat or a tractor in front of it, I was sitting in the tractor. The compactor that I was using loads garbage in two stages, 30,000-pound bales at a time. The first bale had entered. The chlorine was in that first bale. It came halfway into the trailer, and it stayed there for about 15 minutes while they prepared the second bale. In that 15 minutes, that chlorine powder had come in contact with a small portion of water, not a lot. We used chlorine. I have a pool of my own, a hot tub. We put the chlorine into a large vat of water, no problem. But you put that same chlorine into a gallon of water, you've got what you may consider to be mustard gas, a very, very toxic gas. This is what transpired in the trailer during that 15 minutes between bales. At the offset of starting to push the second bale into the truck, all the chlorine gas that was within the trailer that had compiled within that 15 minutes was compressed and shot out the window, completely engulfing me into a white gas that I couldn't even see my hand in front of my face. I instantly gagged, got out of the truck, got to the ground, singled for the compact operator to leave the area with me, and within 45 minutes, I was spitting blood, my sinuses were blistered, my neck, where the perspiration was on my neck, was blistered. Anywhere, any exposed skin that I had sweat on, blistered. I went to the hospital. I was treated for inhalation of the chemical. My lungs were burnt. My sinuses bled for 3 months. And to this day, I had just finished going through a series of tests for my lungs this past week. They now consider me to be asthmatic due to the fact of the chlorine exposure in January of 97. And I think the biggest issue here is people don't look at chlorine as a problem because every household has it that has a swimming pool or a hot tub. This is fine if we're putting it into a vast amount of water, but it mixes in trash with other things, oils, as we heard earlier, can be explosive, yet you put it with just a little bit of water, it becomes very, very toxic and a heavy, heavy gas. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, we think there are alternatives to putting chlorine products in the garbage. In both the Portland metropolitan area and in the Eugene area, there are permanent hazardous waste collection facilities where people can come and bring the products such as this. There are private companies throughout the state that do offer collection services that are much preferable to putting it in the garbage. And the DEQ also sponsors one-day collection events throughout the state. So we think that there are alternatives. Perhaps these do need to be expanded to some degree, but there are alternatives today. I also wanted to point out to you that Oregon wouldn't be the first to adopt stricter standards. California and Minnesota have already adopted stricter standards. You also have some written testimony from Browning Ferrous Industries. They're one of the largest waste companies in the United States, and they point out that this has been a problem throughout the country, and so it's not unique, of course, to just Oregon. And they, BFI certainly supports the legislation. In closing, what I'd like to do is just read from the label from this product that was purchased in Oregon. And on the label, it does say that the following: there's danger, highly corrosive, causes skin and eye damage, may be fatal if swallowed. Contamination with moisture, dirt, organic matter, other chemicals, or any foreign matter may start a chemical reaction which could result in the generation of heat, the liberation of hazardous gases, and possible generation of fire. This is a chemical that we don't want to have our employees exposed to or the public who uses our facility. So we urge your support of this legislation, And we hope we can move it forward as soon as possible so we can stop the kind of injuries that Don suffered from.
Senator Corcoran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So chlorine, I just basically am so old I can barely remember my periodic table, but you have the inert gases, fluorine, chlorine. Why wouldn't, do you just not run across the other ones? I mean, I assume they would be equally volatile, equally dangerous.
Mr. Chair and Senator, certainly we find other hazardous products in the garbage. Some of the common acids used in the construction industry, for example, are things that we find. This is the most common, and perhaps what we consider to be the most dangerous. It's very, very reactive, can produce very large toxic gas clouds. So this is the one that we would like to see out of the garbage. Our preference, of course, would be to see all hazardous out of the garbage.
Sure. So the second question is, why does somebody throw this stuff away?
Mr. Chair and Senator, I think I've heard a number of reasons. Probably most common is they just didn't know it was dangerous and have thrown it away. That's why Metro's embarked on quite an education program in our area to try to get the word out on it. It is dated. The product can go out of date, so that's another reason. Another thing that I have heard is we have had cases of pool supply businesses that have gone out of business. And when they go out of business, they have an inventory on hand. It can be quite a large inventory. And, of course, the cheapest way currently is to simply throw it in the garbage. And that can be very large quantities of chlorine at that point that could end up in the garbage.
Oh, just really quickly, that's what the question I was going to ask you was about your educational program, because I've heard some of the ads you folks have run urging people to handle batteries and different products and pesticides and stuff in certain ways. And it sure seemed like this would fit the model if, in fact, it was in place. But the other main question I'm going to ask, is there any reason not to vent that trailer and fit it right out towards the driver of that goat, but then, in fact, to put it in the top and the front? Is it the fact you don't, I mean, it could be at least something directing that away from the operator. That just seems like a really dangerous scenario.
Mr. Chair, the trailers are vented. There are, I think, six vents. Small as they may be, there are six vents along each, or three on each side of the trailer, and the back doors are open when it's loaded. But the vent door, the main vent door in the front, is when they tip these trailers, this vent door allows air to rush in so it doesn't collapse the trailer. But the other vents, although they are small, they are there.
But as they were pushing forward, they were passing those other vents as they were bringing that load up to the front of that trailer, and so the main discharge point then was out the front vent towards you.
Yes, Mr.
Possible. I realize that you're going to push a large mass of air as you're loading it, but is there a way that you could limit, at least while loading, the amount of air that would come out the front vent?
No, sir. The prevention that Metro has put into effect at this point is it's always been that the driver stayed in front of this vent door to watch material come in, to watch for foreign objects that may rupture the sides of the trailer. Metro has now said we don't want our drivers in front of that vent because of my accident. They have now installed a camera, so the man that's operating and pushing this load views a camera or a screen in his shack to watch the load come through. So we no longer have to be in front of that. But that still doesn't protect those men that are on the floor that this stuff could come in contact with.
Benefit of all my younger colleagues here have the experience with the military. One thing that they do is training or used to push you without a gas mask into room, small hut, or had some of this gas present there, not in a real large capacity. But you could not really get in there and get a gas mask on, no matter what you did, without having at least some contact and at least getting the odor of this stuff. A couple of the guys in my particular were a little careless tests their gas masks weren't as good as they should have been. They actually hospitalized one of the guys from contact with this type of gas with just a minor fraction of what obviously Delma here has suffered. And the whole idea of the thing was to press upon us contact with that gas, just to understand how important it was to gas mask on quick and properly. Because without even clearing the mask, just what after you would get in the mask, self as you put it on would be dangerous, literally to your life. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I can certainly guess wouldn't be too much sitting in the truck and wondering that exactly which taking the comments way further today, you know. That's something like that is that's a question roulette that I would want to play on.
I'm very fortunate to be here.
Yes, I was going to say, from what they told us, the person that had suffered the amount of what you have done around today. You're here. I'm sorry that you're still suffering. Probably maybe permanently suffering results from that. But, well, it's a real.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Right now, hang on before you folks get away. We may hear other testimony, but right now, as amended, you folks are fine with the bill. Okay, great. Thank you. Brad, who's next here?
Kristen Mitchell, Oregon Refuse and Recycling Association.
And a member of the Ruby musical group. I won't mention their other stage name.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Kristen Mitchell. I'm the Governmental Affairs Director for the Oregon Refuse and Recycling Association, which is the trade association representing solid waste and recycling collectors in the state, and also many of the businesses that operate transfer stations and material recovery facilities and landfills. I found out about the amendments to this bill late on Friday, and I spent today trying to get information back from my members about how it would affect them, and I got about 8 responses from Medford, Pendleton, Bend, McMinnville, Woodburn, Boardman, and a couple from Corvallis, and all of the responses were in opposition to the bill as it would be amended. And the first point that we would want to make is that worker safety is very important. It's very important to our member companies, and they spend a lot of time and money working hard to both educate and protect their workers. We do a lot of training. It can be annual training with quarterly follow-up. Some of the managers of those stations receive 40 hours a week, or 40 hours of training. Others are 8 hours for other employees worth of training. They have personal protective devices. They wear Tyvek suits, they have gloves and boots. The full face respirators can be available. They do already waste load inspections that they're required to do pursuant to their permits to determine what's in the loads that are coming into the landfills and what types of materials should not be accepted. But having stressed the importance of that safety, hazards still exist for workers and also for the customers that come to those sites. I just asked them some questions about what are the things they've seen come to the landfill, and it must have been ammunition week or something, but I heard of one place in Eugene, a recycling center actually, that had a grenade launcher and grenade come through. And a number of places see shotgun shells, bullets, mortar rounds, rockets. There's been just lots of things that you wouldn't expect to see in a site that come through and, of course, aren't acceptable at the site. There are other hazards that are not banned. All households have this waste, and waste from conditionally exempt generators. Those are generators of hazardous waste that, for purposes of the type of material or waste that they generate and the amount, are still allowed to send those materials to solid waste landfills instead of other landfills. So, for example, some paint products or related products, garden chemicals, as I think of pesticides or herbicides, which chlorine apparently is technically a pesticide. From Pendleton, I heard flour dust, as in from flour mills, that the dust is easily inhaled, and so they have to pay attention to that. Simple things like broken glass. One landfill reported that they see acid, get a smoldering mass of it about once a week, and they run over and put kitty litter on it and try and keep customers and employees away from it. So these are things that they're seeing quite a bit of time. And even if there is a ban, people will still find ways to dispose of these things in the landfill. They constantly see sharp needles, basically, which are supposed to be disposed of in red, rigid containers. And if they aren't in those containers, then they're being illegally disposed of. But a lot of people that use needles don't carry around the red, rigid containers to get rid of them. And also things like air conditioners are on the list. Large appliances are on the list of banned items. When one landfill reported they see at least three a week, and usually they can get rid of air conditioners fairly easily, pull them out, they pay to get the freon removed and recycle the rest of it. But the one example that I thought was most interesting was the air conditioner that was sewn into the back of a sofa so that it could be then disposed of in the landfill. But they still found it, so I guess it didn't work for the generator. The rather interesting way to try and get rid of something. If they don't send them to the landfill, we think you're going to see them in other places. You'll see roadside or forest dumping. There have been a lot of problems in those areas with illegal dumping. And we had one member report that recycling depots are seeing more materials that certainly aren't recyclables and in some cases may be hazardous, but they can't really tell what it is that's coming in there. So those are some of our concerns with doing a ban. Our theory at ORA is that you're better off to do an education program than you are to try and do these bans. If you educate people that are the good actors but are unaware of the danger, then they will change their behavior. If you are educating bad actors, they'll still find a way to illegally get rid of this stuff. It's still going to show up in the landfills or somewhere else. We know that the ban talks about landfill operators can't knowingly accept the materials, but we're not sure what the knowingly standard would mean. And exactly what is the responsibility of the disposal site. They currently do waste audits to look at materials. How will they have to do that in order to meet the standard of not knowingly taking the materials? They feel like bans put them in the position of not only having to police the loads that are arriving at the landfill, but they are also the police. Because if they accept materials that are banned, then they also may be subject to enforcement from the Department of Environmental Quality, which deals with bans and banned materials, and they have penalties that can be levied against the landfill operators that inappropriately accept or inappropriately accept materials. And there are also, of course, OSHA-related issues that would be involved. There are no reasonable, better alternative disposal options, particularly outside of the metro area. I don't think our members want to see these materials coming into their landfills in any real way, but on the other hand, they're the better alternative than other choices that are there, or they may be the only choice that's available in some locations. They're concerned about how this would be enforced, and they think that their philosophy on this is to figure out how to minimize the risk and provide the service, train the employees, educate the generators, and don't put the landfills in the position of being both the policing and the police. And that's my testimony. And I'd be happy to bring somebody back that could speak more eloquently on this, someone from one of our landfills. If I had a little more time to do that, I would do that.
We have a problem with the amendment, and we can deal with that. But I tell you, you've raised enough questions in my mind that I wouldn't mind having another opportunity to look at this. The other thing, if a number of folks would look at this from the standpoint of whether you could, in fact, address the issue with their own regulations, or whether we can provide the mechanism for a metro or local jurisdiction to do that. Okay, appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, let's do this. Would you notify Brad when your folks are ready, and we'll get back to this issue, because I think it's an issue of a real concern. When I was talking with Mr. Matt before we started this hearing, I described an incident involving chlorine because I handled the concentrated chlorine, and it caught me completely off guard because I've always been around these things, so I could imagine what kind of circumstances he was in. And we need to find the very best.
And, Mr. Chair, I think it's horrifying, awful thing that happened to him, so I hope we can anyway fix it for everyone.
Appreciate that. Okay, thanks. And what did I do with my hand?
Rory, on in DEQ.
Thank you, and good evening, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lori Arnon, Assistant to the Director for the Department of Environmental Quality. I'll be brief in my comments on Senate Bill 964 because I think you've heard a lot of good testimony already, and I'll just have a few points to add. The first thing is, of course, we do share concerns about worker safety from exposure to this and other chemicals and support the desire to keep calcium hypochlorite out of the waste stream. It was a pretty horrifying story that I just heard. It was the first I'd heard of how it happened, and that's very frightening and really something that we wouldn't want to see happen. However, we're concerned about a ban on disposal when there may not be feasible waste management alternatives for everybody. And we think that if it were to be banned, there would need to be a comprehensive educational effort to let people know what the alternatives are. At this point, we know that the Portland area has two permanent household hazardous waste collection depots that take small quantities of pesticides and other hazardous waste. But outside the Portland area, there aren't a lot of alternatives. It was mentioned that DEQ does conduct household hazardous waste collection days around the state, but it's a limited program. It only goes to a few communities, and then only every few years. So without more feasible alternatives, a ban could result in disposal practices that might be worse and more threatening to the environment and people's safety than the existing problems. And just to summarize, I do believe Metro has the ability to adopt a local ordinance, and since they have brought it up, and I appreciate the fact that they're concerned, it may be useful to have it done locally to see how it works and then take a look at whether there's anything that can work beyond that. And I'd be happy to answer questions if I can.
Would you work with the folks in Metro to see whether or not they have that authority? Because it may be a case that they can just exercise that if we need to do anything to enable them to make that decision locally. But, you know, I'm really moved by what was said by the solid waste folks and the fact that if, in fact, you make it very difficult to dispose of it, it ends up in some ditch someplace. And I have some folks from the coast who've done a lot of work trying to collect things out of streams and creeks that have been dumped because it was inconvenient for someone to dispose of it. One of those things, if I had my druthers, I would subsidize this industry that was free to deliver anything that I'm ever going to get my wish on that one. But if it would be possible to work this out, we'll wait to hear from you folks, too, on that. And because it's a very serious issue, and I think what's good about all of these discussions we're having, these need to be addressed, and let's get it done.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
As you remember, Chemist, I'd like just a little better explanation of what happens. Let's say that I've got a spa or a pool. I've got a half a jar of this stuff left over that I can't use reasonably without a date. What happens if I, for instance, throw it out on the ground and put a hose on it or put it on my driveway and put a hose on it, wash it down, and stand down or upwind from it so I don't get any of the fumes. Obviously, it's not going to be enough of a gas cloud if I don't have a neighbor living 50 feet downwind from me or something like that. If I do it unbeknownst to a crowd or something like that standing around, it's going to disappear and be gone. But what is the residue? Is the residue also or whatever is left, is that dangerous?
Chair and Senator Fisher, I am not an expert on that either. I could certainly check with the folks in our office who know more about how chemicals might react and let you know what would be leftover residues and what that might cause. I could get that information to you.
Any further questions? Thank you very much. Testify on Senate Bill 964.
The reason I say that, we put it by little amounts in the spas and the pools, and keep adding it over a period of time. So it's ultimately whatever residue is getting out, mm-hmm. and and then the water obviously goes down the drain, and if the pool doesn't go into the sewer, my case where I have a spa out with no type of a drain situation, it flower beds and whatever.
When you land in Los Angeles, you begin to wonder what it's like when all of that water gets. There's a lot of it out there. Ed, you want to say something? Or you, now, keep it short.
We're going to say this thing. Extremely short.
Extremely short.
Chair Senator Fisher, I bring up that question.
For the record.
Huh?
For the record.
For the record, my name is Edward Gostin, Lake County, Oregon. But dealing with your question, too, I bring the concern dealing with rivers and streams, dealing with not only a fish, but elk and other habitat if it's dumped out. So that consideration should be looked into as well, dealing with all that and dealing with the hazards and that of work. If they got something that's working right now, you know, consider all the options.
Thank you. Okay, if there's no further business to come before the committee, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 964 with a tap of the gavel. Will be adjourned.